Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we open our show with a disturbing national story, including some local and worldwide reactions to the violence at a white supremacist gathering in Charlottesville, Virginia, where three people are dead and at least 35 more are injured. Here in San Diego's East County, we'll tell you how beleaguered El Cajon Councilman Ben Colasio is firing back with a countersuit claiming he's been defamed by two beauty pageant contestants and others who are suing him for fraud, sexual harassment, and more. Then on Green Scene, hear how you'll soon be able to take a virtual trek along county trails with Google. And you can learn what a judge had to say about those shrinking airline seats. Our newsmaker interview today is with Rebecca Smart. She's a ranger at Mission Trails Regional Park, and she's here to give you some safety tips for hiking with your dog. You may be surprised to learn just how dangerous some local trails are for dogs and how many have perished from the heat. Learn how to keep your dog safe from heat and other trail hazards on today's show. On the second half of our show today, we'll take you on the road to Julian, where you'll hear about this historic Gold Rush town's colorful history, visit a gold mine, get some gold panning tips, and learn why apple pies are the new gold in this town that was founded by former Civil War soldiers and freed slaves and continues to be a welcome place today for people from diverse backgrounds from across the nation and around the world. It's back to school time, and we'll have some tips today for motorists to help keep children safe as they walk to school or to their school buses. And then on sports, Liz Alper will tell you about a Southern California city chosen to host an upcoming Summer Olympics. We'll have all these stories and more, so please stay tuned for the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. Unite the Right, the largest white supremacist gathering in decades, was declared an unlawful assembly by the city of Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend, where three people are dead and at least 35 injured. Governor Terry McAuliffe declared a state of emergency, and politicians across the country have spoken out to denounce the hate groups participating. Former Ku Klux Klan Imperial Wizard David Duke had earlier credited Donald Trump with inspiring the rally. In an interview with the Indianapolis Star, Duke said, "We are going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump," adding, "That's why we voted for Donald Trump, because he said he's going to take our country back, and that's what we're going to do." The gathering had been projected to draw thousands of Ku Klux Klan members, neo-Nazis, and other alt-right hate group members. In a rally the night before the main event, many carried lit torches, shields, guns, and other weapons. The groups came ostensibly to protest plans to remove a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from a park in this university town, but many participants made Nazi salutes en masse, chanted blood and soil, and lobbed racial slurs at protesters, including some holding Black Lives Matter signs. After police cleared the protest area, a car plowed into a crowd of people protesting against the white supremacists, killing 20-year-old Heather Heyer and injuring 19 people, including one with a skull fracture. The others were injured in additional skirmishes. The driver, 20-year-old Alex Fields Jr., was seen accelerating to build up speed for several blocks before striking the crowd. He has been arrested and charged with second-degree murder. His teacher says Fields was a Nazi sympathizer, the Washington Post reports. The FBI has announced that it has opened a civil rights investigation into the attack, also seeking to find out if the driver acted alone or if others may have been involved. Two state troopers monitoring the protest also died when their helicopter crashed into a nearby woods. The Virginia organizer of the Unite the Right rally, Jason Kessler, tried to hold a news conference the day after the killings, but was drowned out by protesters shouting, "Murderer!" and blaring horns. He ran away and was tackled by the crowd, but police intervened to whisk him away. Later, he tweeted that violence rules over speech and ideas in hashtag Charlottesville. Charlottesville's mayor, Michael Signer, said on CNN that the victims didn't need to die. He faulted Trump for courting white supremacists in his campaign and repeatedly refusing to condemn such groups, adding, "Two things need to be said over and over again, domestic terrorism and white supremacy." President Donald Trump, speaking to media at Trump National Golf Club while on vacation in New Jersey over the weekend, said of the Charlottesville tragedy, "We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence." And then he added, "On many sides." Trump's refusal to denounce white supremacists specifically drew criticism from some who said that such silence continued a pattern of ignoring terrorist acts from right-wing extremists, such as recent bombings of mosques. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, a California Democrat, urged the president to say, "White supremacy is an affront to American values." House Speaker Paul Ryan, a Republican from Wisconsin, tweeted, "White supremacy is a scourge. This hate and its terrorism must be confronted and defeated." Vice President Mike Pence, who was traveling in Colombia, stated, "We have no tolerance for hate and violence from white supremacists, neo-Nazis, or the KKK. Pence promised that the administration would bring the Justice Department's full resources to investigate and prosecute those responsible for the violence. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina told Fox News that the white supremacists seem to believe they have a friend in Donald Trump in the White House, adding, "I would urge the president to dissuade them of the idea that he is sympathetic to their cause." On Monday, in the wake of such criticism, President Trump finally did speak out forcefully, denouncing white supremacism and Nazism by name. Here's what he had to say.
"To anyone who acted criminally in this weekend's racist violence, you will be held fully accountable. Justice will be delivered. As I said on Saturday, we condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America. And as I have said many times before, no matter the color of our skin, we all live under the same laws. We all salute the same great flag. And we are all made by the same Almighty God. We must love each other, show affection for each other, and unite together in condemnation of hatred, bigotry, and violence. We must rediscover the bonds of love and loyalty that bring us together as Americans. Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. We are a nation founded on the truth that all of us are created equal. We are equal in the eyes of our Creator. We are equal under the law, and we are equal under our Constitution. Those who spread violence in the name of bigotry strike at the very core of America."
The King Center, founded by Coretta Scott King, widow of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King, tweeted, "Racism never left America." San Diego Democratic Congressman Scott Peters tweeted, "These expressions of racism and hatred are neither American nor Christian, and all the patriotic and devout should say so." Senator Dianne Feinstein, a California Democrat, said of the Charlottesville attacks, "Violent acts of hate and bigotry have no place in America." California Senator Kamala Harris stated, "This hate is against everything America stands for. We must all stand united against it." The incident has also drawn international condemnation. British Prime Minister Theresa May tweeted, "Our thoughts and prayers are with hashtag Charlottesville. The UK stands with the US against racism, hatred, and violence." Israel's Education Minister Naftali Bennett called on the White House to condemn Nazi symbols used at the rally. The Israeli minister said, It is on the leaders of the U.S. to condemn and denounce manifestations of anti-Semitism that we have seen in recent days. A planned prayer vigil for Heather Heyer, who was murdered in the car ramming, was canceled due to a threat of violence. But many turned out to march in her memory anyway, despite the threat. USA Today reports that Victoria Jackson, a co-worker and friend, remembered Heyer for standing up for what she believed in, adding, "She was a beautiful soul." Jackson admitted she was afraid, but marched anyway. The vicious attacks, far from intimidating people, are having exactly the opposite effect. In Charlottesville, racists in the Unite the Right rally were drowned out by religious leaders and others who formed a line singing, "This Little Light of Mine," drowning out curses and slurs, NBC reports, and in cities across the nation, including here in San Diego. Those horrified by the racial violence at Charlottesville have swiftly organized peaceful marches and protests, taking a stand against hatred, drawing far bigger crowds than Unite the Right. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
El Cajon Councilman Ben Colasio is countersuing two contestants in the Miss Middle East beauty pageant that he founded, alleging that his reputation has been harmed by their claims that include fraud and sexual harassment. One contestant, Paris Cargar, claimed Colasio offered her a win in the pageant if she would sleep with him. She has also claimed he made inappropriate comments about her breasts, jiggling when she walked across the stage, then asked that she do it again. In the cross-complaint, Colasio claims he was merely trying to teach Cargar the correct and classy way to walk down the runway, according to his countersuit. He notes that Cargar later attended a function at the home Colasio shares with his wife. The other contestant, Zala Tolfkew, was stripped of her crown after she refused to allow Colasio to post on her social media accounts, and Colasio claimed she had not fulfilled pageant appearance requirements. When nude photos of her face photoshopped onto someone else's nude body appeared on Instagram, she accused Colasio of posting them. The cross complaint suggests that perhaps someone else posted the fake nude photos and noted that she held a Kurdish flag upside down, which may have offended someone in her own culture, the San Diego Union-Tribune reports. The councilman who founded the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce recently lost a trademark dispute and has changed the name to Middle Eastern Chamber of Commerce. Colasio also paid a $10,000 settlement in a prior fraud case involving damage to property at a market owned by Lena Chari, damage that the court found was caused by a car wash owned by Colasio. Colasio sought a permanent restraining order against Chari, which the court denied. He claims in his cross-complaint that Chari has an obsessive fixation on him because she was banned from participating in the beauty pageant, but the complaints allege a pattern of targeting those who have crossed him. The Three Brothers Taco Shop, also a plaintiff, claims that after it refused to allow Colasio to post a campaign sign, he smeared the restaurant with an online poll claiming it was the worst Mexican food in El Cajon. Colasio's countersuit notes that other companies didn't post his signs and were not targeted by negative polls. Colasio seeks compensatory and punitive damages as well as court costs and attorney fees for what he contends is defamation of character. But Tofkew's lawyer, Jimmy Parker, called Colasio's cross-complaint unfounded and says it's a continuation of harassment against his client, the Union Tribune reports. Parker says that he will seek sanctions against Colasio for filing the countersuit. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Getz with our Green Scene Report. San Diego is known for its many hiking trails, but sometimes you want to know what you're getting into before you make that trek. Or maybe you just want to see if the view really is as spectacular as the photos. County Parks and Recreation and Google have joined forces to help give you a glimpse of local trails before going. Soon, there will be select trails highlighted on Google's site with 360-degree views. Here's how it was done. In April, the County Parks and Recreation Department deployed the Google Trekker Kit to Agua Caliente County Park. A ranger completed a lengthy training and test and then he assembled the 40-pound pack before taking it out in Moonlight Canyon. The 360-degree camera at the top of the pack snaps images every 2 seconds, capturing real-life trail experiences that can be viewed online. A complement to Google Street View, Google Trekker takes users off-roading through some of America's most popular outdoor venues in a virtual environment. The pack began its journey in the desert, traveled through the Mountain Borrego Preserves, collecting footage of Santa Isabel East and West and Vulcan Mountain, then into Ramona with stops at the Ramona Grasslands and Barnett Ranch. Central San Diego destinations included Gooden Ranch, Sycamore Canyon and Los Peñasquitos County Preserve. Lakeside area destinations included Lindo Lake County Park, Lakeside Linkage, Oak Oasis County Preserve, and both Flume Trails. North County destinations included San Alejo Ecological Reserve, Guajome Regional Park, and Wilderness Gardens County Preserve. A total of 10 rangers wore the pack, collecting images of 14 different parks and preserves across the region. The equipment is currently en route to Google headquarters, where a team will process and edit the content for online use in about 6 months. Look out for County Parks and Trails on Google Trekker, which will soon be online to help you get a 360-degree view before you go.
In recent years, passengers have been complaining about shrinking seat sizes on airplanes with inadequate legroom space, while airlines seek to squeeze out maximum profits. But last month, the U.S. Court of Appeals ordered the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, to conduct a review to determine whether those claustrophobic small seats pose safety hazards to passengers. In the case, Flyers Rights Education Fund, Inc. versus the FAA, the court found that the FAA has a pattern of rejecting public concerns without adequate basis for doing so. For instance, the FAA dismissed public concerns that smaller seats might make it harder for passengers to escape during an emergency, but they cited no studies to back up that conclusion. The court ruling says of that FAA action, "That makes no sense." Adding, as a matter of basic physics, at some point, seat and passenger dimensions would become so squeezed as to impede the ability of passengers to extricate themselves from their seats and get over to an aisle. A San Diego Free Press article reports that the FAA has similarly ignored complaints by local residents over increased airplane noise and low flights, an issue that some East County residents have complained about as traffic into Lindbergh Field has been rerouted over their neighborhoods. And yet the FAA ignored public concerns in rolling out its Southern California Metroplex project, or NextGen, and has now released its Noise Integrated Routing System model for public comments. But the prospect of the FAA actually addressing those concerns in a meaningful way seems remote, given the FAA history of ignoring public concerns without documenting its own basis for decisions that affect the safety and well-being of passengers or the public at large. But now, thanks to the court's ruling, the FAA will be forced to conduct a new study on the safety impacts of those shrinking seats. And once it's completed, a judge may find grounds to order airlines to increase space per passenger on airlines based in the U.S. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. If you're listening to our show on the internet today, you may not be aware that the station has been knocked off the air on the radio because the transmitter was struck by lightning in the recent storm. A new circuit board is needed, which costs over $2,000 for the part alone. And there could be more damage, as the engineer is still assessing the situation. You can help get KNSJ back on the air, aired across San Diego and Imperial counties, by making a donation at knsj.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Park Ranger Rebecca Smart. Rebecca is a ranger with the Mission Trails Regional Park, which is one of the largest urban parks in America. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marianne.
How large is the park now? I know they've expanded.
The park is just under 8,000 acres, so you are correct. It is one of the largest open space preserve areas in the United States.
It has a lot of beautiful, beautiful hiking trails, including the trail on Coles Mountain, which is one of the most popular, if not the most popular, in San Diego County. But we're here today because Rebecca gave me a call and reached out and told me that, frankly, she is tired of, unfortunately, having to rescue a lot of dogs that get in trouble on this trail, and worse, carrying dead dogs off. So she wanted us to bring her on the show and kind of get a warning out to folks that in this extreme hot weather we've been having, how dangerous this can be for pets. So thank you for caring, Rebecca.
Absolutely. This is my passion. The number one element to remember about dog fatalities on trails is that it is entirely preventable. Accidents happen. You may fall or twist an ankle at some point, but this is entirely preventable with just a little bit of prior planning and thought for your pet.
Yeah. Now, you've told me that in a typical year recently, we've been seeing 24 dogs on average dying on that trail alone. That's just staggering. What has the park done so far to try to warn people about this?
Well, like you said, it is staggering, and one is always too many. But yes, there are probably dozens each season that pass away due to heat stress and heat stroke on trails. The city of San Diego and our ranger team works tirelessly to try to help educate people on trails and make sure that folks know before they set out and before they have a tragic experience that it is dangerous for pets. Mission Trails temperatures range from, say, 80 degrees to over 100 degrees. And that type of weather can last from May on through October. If you're coming from a coastal area and not acclimated to the type of weather at Mission Trails and mountain preserves, you could be in for a very deadly experience with your pet.
Yeah, I know you've told me that they put up signs recently warning people not to bring dogs on this trail, and that there's now a penalty if somebody does that and their dog has trouble, that they might even be fined or cited for animal cruelty.
That's correct. We do have warning signage placed at every trailhead, and we do always come from a place of education and care first. But the public should know and be aware that for those folks that do disregard signage and disregard warnings, that they can be cited for numerous offenses, animal cruelty, which is a misdemeanor citation, as well as inhumane treatment and lesser offenses. So for egregious cases of disregard, the public can and will be cited.
So what are some guidelines? Obviously, a lot of people love their dogs. Hiking with dogs is a popular adventure, and a lot of dogs probably enjoy it too. But how can you enjoy the outdoors here in San Diego with your dog and minimize the chances that your dog will be put at risk? Prevention, obviously, is far better than having to deal with a pet in distress. So first of all, are there times of the year, hours of the day, when you just shouldn't hike with your dog, or are there temperature guidelines? What do you recommend?
Absolutely. We recommend that during warmer weather that folks leave their pets at home. So during the heat of the day, say from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. when the sun is really at its peak, you do not want to bring your dog out hiking on mountain trails. That goes for Mission Trails or any other mountainous open space area within the county.
Right. I'd like to mention here that while we're talking about trails in Mission Trails Regional Park, there have been a lot of problems in Cleveland National Forest. And in fact, the two trails with the worst record in terms of rescuing both people and dogs or having dogs expire are the Three Sisters Falls Trail and the Cedar Creek Falls Trail in Cleveland National Forest. Both are very steep with little to no shade, much like the Coles Mountain Trail.
Correct.
What are the guidelines in terms of how much water one should bring along for your dog when you're hiking, or for that matter, yourself?
Well, absolutely. The guideline to remember is to always bring more than you think you're going to need. If you're planning on bringing a liter for every mile that you and your dog hike, make sure to bring extra. Oftentimes, I will be out on trail and someone else will need it. And you can essentially really help a situation if someone else does not bring enough water. So always bring more than you think you'll need. With pets, I'd like to emphasize that bringing drinking water along for your pet is absolutely essential, no matter the time of day. So bring some kind of collapsible bowl. If your pet doesn't drink out of a water bottle, make sure that they have water along. But keep in mind that during the heat of the day, when you're exercising your dog, especially on a mountain trail, that combination of exertion and exposure to the elements can be so brutal that drinking water alone will not suffice to keep your pet safe.
Yeah, they can get overheated very, very quickly. And I understand that some breeds, while it can happen to any dog, there just was a husky that died up there, and they're a very hardy breed, but that some breeds are more prone to this and will feel the heat in extreme ways more quickly.
Absolutely. Always gauge your pet just like you would your own physical activity levels. Certain breeds like boxers, bull terriers, bulldogs, pit bulls are very sensitive to heat stroke. They have shorter legs and a shorter snout, a shorter nose, which makes breathing more difficult for them. So you'll notice that those breeds, often before they even get out on the trail, are overheating and very rapid panting.
Yeah. Now, another thing you can do is to work up your dog's endurance by starting with smaller, shorter level trails, maybe trails in shade, before you even think about an extreme trail like that, even in the best of weather, the coolest of weather. That said, even on level trails, in extreme heat, there can be damage to dogs' paws, right?
Yes, dogs' paws can blister and scab and bleed very easily on pavement, on uneven terrain, on the type of rocky soil that we have here in San Diego County.
Yeah, it gets very hot very, very quickly.
It's very hot, so always be mindful of the temperature of the pavement. If it feels too hot to the touch for you to imagine hiking barefoot with a fur coat on, then it is absolutely too dangerous for your pet.
Very true. It's always a good idea, of course, to bring a cell phone along with GPS. While typically you have great reception out there in Mission Trails, especially on some of these other backcountry trails in Cleveland National Forest and elsewhere, where you may have spotty reception, it's not a complete answer. But you should also be aware that there's kind of a pro and con to hiking in the evening. It's cooler for the dog if you're going to bring them. But the downside of that is, you've told me, the rangers are off duty after what time?
Well, it depends on the park, but most mountain trails are open from sunrise to sunset, meaning that is when staff is there. Mm-hmm. We do suggest that if you must hike with your dog, you want to come out very early in the morning. If you're only able to hike in the evening, just be mindful that there may not be staff available wherever you're at.
Yeah.
And it's at your own discretion. So if you need help, another reason why you need to have a plan. Know the difficulty of the trail ahead of time. Know what kind of temperatures to expect that day. Before I start work every day, I always check my phone to see what the weather is going to be like at Mission Trails.
Yeah.
Just so I can have an idea of what to expect for that day.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. And also, certainly in these summer months, thunderstorms is also a possibility too. And you don't want to be on a mountain if there are going to be lightning strikes. Now, there's one more trail danger that we haven't talked about yet here in East County, and that's rattlesnakes. What can people do when they're hiking to minimize the chances that their pet would be bitten by a rattlesnake, or for that matter, themselves?
When you see wildlife of any kind, but rattlesnakes as well, on a trail, first of all, consider yourself kind of lucky to witness natural habitat. It's great that we still have places where we can see wildlife. If you see a snake, our best suggestion is to let it do its thing, so to speak.
Just stop and freeze and wait for it to move on.
You never want to put your hands or feet in a place where you can't see. Snakes often rest in shady shrub areas. Mm-hmm. You always want to keep your dog on a leash for Yes. their safety and for yours. There are multiple reasons to keep your pet leashed, including wildlife. Dogs are attracted to things that run, like rabbits. If a dog was to chase a little critter into the bush and then come upon a rattlesnake, it could be a very, very bad day.
Yeah.
Now, veterinary clinics do offer something called a rattlesnake vaccine.
But those only buy you time. They don't really save your dog from a snake bite. From my understanding, we just did a story on this, is that at best it will just buy you time by delaying the effect of the venom and giving you a little more time to get to the vet. So we still need to get the dog to the vet on an emergency basis.
Absolutely. Rattlesnake aversion training is also offered for animals. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you live in a mountainous or rural area or spend a lot of time outdoors in areas where there are snakes, you might want to look into some of those other rattlesnake training info. Yeah. But the best judgment or rule of thumb is to just let a snake pass. If it is on trail and it is a hazard, feel free to try to call the main ranger line at the park, wherever you're at. Let the staff know that there's a snake on the trail. If there is someone available, we always try to respond.
Interesting. So they can come move the snake.
Yes, we would actually come physically move the snake, but let us do that. You never want to put yourself in any kind of danger.
Yeah, I don't think most people are going to need a lot of convincing to not try moving the rattlesnake by themselves, hopefully.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. I certainly want to say the trails in Mission Trails Regional Park are absolutely beautiful, and we really don't want to discourage anybody from going and enjoying that or bringing your dog along, but just do it in a safe way, folks. Wait until the weather's cooler and, you know, and pace yourself and your dog, and you can really get out and enjoy nature and see some beautiful things and make sure to keep your dog safe as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Miriam. And if I could just add, for any folks out there that would like to get involved in volunteering at places like Mission Trails, we can always use the help in trying to educate people. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of outreach and prevention education, which is what this is all about. If you're interested in helping with canine-related issues, please contact me. I'd love to have your help on some of this. And again, if you see something, say something. If you see an animal or a person in distress, no matter what trail you're on, contact staff, contact public safety. You may indeed save a life.
Very important words of wisdom. If you've just tuned in, listeners, we have been speaking with Rebecca Smart, who is a ranger at Mission Trails Regional Park. And listeners, the most important takeaway from today's show that Ranger Smart wants you all to know is to be sure not to take your dog on steep mountain trails such as Coles Mountain from Memorial Day in late May through the fall months. Wait until the weather's cooler, because they've had over 24 dogs die in the last year on that Coles Mountain trail alone, and we don't want your dog to be one of them. You can reach out and contact her or get more information about the trails at the park by visiting Mission Trails Regional Park's website at mtrp.org. Thank you very much, Rebecca, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ in the heart of East County.
Thank you, Miriam. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ. 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. If you're listening to our show on the internet today, you may not be aware that the station has been knocked off the air on the radio because the transmitter was struck by lightning in the recent storm. A new circuit board is needed, which costs over $2,000 for the part alone. And there could be more damage, as the engineer is still assessing the situation. You can help get KNSJ back on the air, aired across San Diego and Imperial Counties, by making a donation at knsj.org.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives. So he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town, since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian Gold Rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the Gold Rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who are the people who founded the town?
Basically, Drury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Drury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on the San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two of the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in a creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddlebags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in a creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories, but I'm the historian for the cemetery too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery, and it's Drury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Drury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Drury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old. And this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s. And then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
These are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those
us?
Those right there, yes. And
wow.
Those were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist. S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard, mm-hmm. and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit, because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them, because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pick that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know. And
had a hunch, maybe.
not Drury. Drury. This is the giant founder of the town is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around.
Mm-hmm.
They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People mm-hmm. are out there trying to get lucky. But, say from 1900, they were pretty much done. But then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Dayton.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guides today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot fun.
So then the real goal is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis,
right,
and those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and mm-hmm. you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Stevan, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the ridges. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You can see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. Now what I do, once you get it in the pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in 1800? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U shape, right? You'd scrape it down into the stream, and you'd rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take the pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out because the gold's heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Stevan over here who's been trying his hand at it. Stevan,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of gold, and the techniques that Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually works.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collector. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The
now
way that
talking.
You could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! You know, your gold strike. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit, because instead of an entrance to the gold mine, they call them adits, A-D-I-T, it's a puzzle.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there. And we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there. And once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover...
Come back. Okay,
bye.
So
we're going to cover...
Bye.
Bye. Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mountain.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all the lights, all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light, and they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a nomadic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The nomadic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet, and our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. There was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet. Yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries, and of course some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie. So we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full-service lunch menu, and, of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes. Got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore. Worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels. Did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center. Ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there. And in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and of course America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This was great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
Soon it will be back to school time when throngs of students will be walking, bicycling, driving, or riding buses to and from school. We were all kids once, so we know we can't count on them to be paying attention. That's why it's important for all of us to use extra caution while driving in school zones. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates that 75 school-age pedestrians are killed each year during school travel. These are preventable deaths. Here are some lessons to share for motorists to help protect children in our communities. It is illegal to pass a school bus that is stopped to load or unload children. School buses use yellow flashing lights to alert motorists that they are preparing to stop to load or unload kids. Red flashing lights and an extending stop sign arm signals to motorists that the bus is stopped and children are getting on or off the bus. So please be sure to stop. The 10 feet around a school bus is where children are in the most danger of being hit. Drivers should not block the crosswalk when stopped at a red light or waiting to make a turn. In a school zone, when a warning flash or flashers are blinking, you must stop to yield the right-of-way to a pedestrian crossing the roadway within a marked crosswalk or at an intersection with no marked crosswalk. Remember, children are unpredictable and hard to see. Take extra care to look out for children not only in school zones, but also in residential areas, playgrounds, and parks. And please, parents, teach your children to look both ways before crossing the street and not take chances. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Liz Alpert. On July 31st, Los Angeles announced a deal to give up their bid to host the 2024 Summer Olympics and instead host the 2028 Olympics. Paris will now host the 2024 Olympics. At a news conference, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti said, "We know we will return the Olympic legacy to what it's all about," he said, adding later, "We're a city that has always been a games changer and again will be in 2028. Los Angeles last hosted the games in 1984 and 1932. Los Angeles is excited about the extra 4 years, noting that that will give city officials time to expand the city's subway system. The Summer Olympics have not been in the United States since Atlanta in 1996. In 2002, Salt Lake City played host to the last Olympics in the country, the Winter Games. There has been minimal opposition to the Games in Los Angeles, which is why the U.S. Olympic Committee withdrew its support for Boston as a potential host in July of 2015. But some opposition was voiced by a group called No Olympics LA, who said, "This is a complete miscarriage of anything remotely resembling democracy," the group said. "We insist that the local media acknowledge the lack of transparency and accountability there is in this last-minute, hastily thrown together plan. The council, mayor, big committee, Donald Trump, and IOC are all colluding to thrust an unvetted plan onto the second largest city in America. Despite the lower construction cost, work still needs to be done to prepare stadiums, many of which are still left over from the 1984 Olympics. The biggest pro is LA is a winner again," said Rick Burton, a professor of sports management at Syracuse and the former chief marketing officer of the United States Olympic Committee.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.